Hello, and welcome to the debut episode of There Is No Planet Earth Stories. This program focuses on the history of underground dance music and club culture in the United States from the perspectives of New York, New Jersey, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. The interviews featured in this program represent different perspectives from within the culture, including dancers, DJs, club staff, promoters, and journalists. For this debut episode, I'm joined by guest Richard Alvarez, representing stories from New York City. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy the show.
First of all, thank you for joining me today in the debut episode of There Is No Planet Earth Stories. Let's start with an introduction, just a brief sort of bio of who you are and where you're from and, you know, what do you do?
My name is Richard Alvarez. I grew up in New York City. I grew up in the Bronx, and I'm an artist. I'm a door whore. I've been working in nightlife for decades. I've been a part of the downtown scene for a while. And, you know, I still work at clubs and I'm creating art and I live to be on the dance floor.
That's great. Thank you. So take us back to the very beginning, if you remember. What was your introduction to New York nightlife? Do you remember the year, where you were, who took you?
Okay, so I don't remember the year. I'm really bad with time. But my sister she was a hustler. And this was like the disco time, right? So they would have these jams in the Bronx where they would set up a system outside and they would jam, right? And it's kind of like the beginning of hip hop as well, which came a little bit later. But my sister would want to go and dance with her friends because she was like this real fabulous dancer and she could spin forever, which was very important if you were doing the hustle. So the only way that she could go was if she brother. So oftentimes we went to these parties and I was introduced to the music long before I really got into it. My sister went to a house party and they were playing Hot Shot. I was in the corner and I lost my mind. And all my sister and all the friends were like, oh my God, look at Richard, look at Richard, look at Richard. And I was in the corner losing my mind. And, you know, that's when I really felt the freedom of being able to express myself and not feeling afraid or unsure. You know, I mean, I was queer. I was very unusual, even within the queer community, right? Because I was so like punk and funky, which, you know, happened later. But, you know, I just didn't fit in many places. So dancing that day, really, I felt free and alive.
Were you going to these Bronx parties before coming out, or was that like sort of all part of the process for you?
Well, I never came out because there was nothing to come out of because I was. But, you know, again, I mean, I think it was very different. Like, we didn't have the language. We didn't have the support. We didn't have the representation. And I felt like a freak, you know, and I was told I was a freak more than once by people. And even if they didn't call me a freak, they would be like, you sound like a girl. What, you know, I was just this like beautiful, like feminine boy, right? And I say beautiful, not, I didn't think I was beautiful. It's not till I look back at the pictures and I'm like, my God, you were so gorgeous. Like, what was your problem? Because I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel beautiful. No one was telling me I felt beautiful, which came later on. But, you know, so coming out, you know, this when one of my cousins once told me that we spoke to your mother and we were like, oh yeah, we knew it. We knew it as soon as, you know, when I was 6 years old, I was checking out my friend's fathers and like, you know, like, so I mean, I don't know when does it happen? Are you born? Like, I, you know.
And then, so when did you discover the whole like underground dance music world of New York City, like outside of the Bronx? When did you come downtown?
So I had a friend, Robin Newland. We went to high school together and she was really cool. And I was attracted to her, and not in, you know, like a romantic way, but I was like, she's cool. And, you know, I went to Kennedy, which is very, you know, very, it was a melange of different cultures and people. And it was really kind of amazing. But she was so cool. And I liked the way she looked. So we started hanging out and she took me to the Mud Club, which Monday nights at the Mud Club was the night. Like the weekends were cool. They were all right. But we would usually go to another club. But I started going to the Mud Club, and then I started going to an after hours called Berlin, which would be the reggae lounge until 2 a.m. And then it would switch over to Berlin. And the man that raised me is from St. Croix. He's as dark as coal, and my mother's white. So at the many of the people would stay from the reggae lounge, and it would turn into like this punk. So it was this melding of different cultures, which felt very good to me. You know, also at the Mud Club, I'd see these rockabilly girls from Jersey who were, you know, going out with these ska boys from Brooklyn. So it felt very natural and it felt very normal to me because that's how I had been raised, you know. Before that, it was always, you know, everything was very separated, it felt. Like the music, WBLS was all Black music, you know, like there was very crossover. You know, this whole thing of crossover, that's where it comes from. The radio station that you listen to depended on your social, you know, I mean, it was like, it was very separated.
Right. And so then, did you ever go to the Loft or Better Days?
So the Loft I went to when it was open, and I didn't like the Loft because they weren't very chic and glamorous. And in my mind, and I did not like, I created this chic, glamorous facade that I had, right? But like the Loft, they were just like, you know, they had on different shoes and it wasn't my cup of tea. Better Days I went to and I would go to regularly. And I remember one Christmas Eve, my mother had bought me a pair of like maroon blood ankle high cowboy boots, like 70s, like really kind of tacky, but like they were fabulous. And I took them, I wore them to Better Days, but I brought my dancing shoes with me, which is what we did often because we had to dance and someone stole my boots. So whenever I think of Better Days, I think of that Christmas Eve and having to go home the next day and tell my mother that the boots that I had wanted for Christmas that she had got me, because my mom and I would always argue about what I was wearing. My mom was just like, why do you dress like that? What is, you know, what's, why do you dress like that? But like from a very young age, I had a very precise way of what I wanted to look like, how I wanted to present myself. Although I didn't, you know, it wasn't about presenting or being, it was just like how I can express myself visually.
And were there any like reoccurring favorite songs from that venue that you just like stand out, that like you, that just whenever you hear, you're like, oh, those days at Better, you know, those times at Better Days?
Well, I mean, Better Days was, you know, like there was this one song, I'm in a Panic, which Ted Patterson and I were talking about it. And then Let's All Chant. You know, I went to Gigi's and Barnum, which was a nightclub where they had, you know, the trans girls on like trapeze. And I mean, I was going out and sneaking into clubs.
Where was
this?
This
was in Midtown.
Okay.
It was in Gigi's Barnum.
Gigi's Barnum.
Gigi's and Barnum. I would go to clubs and they would come and get me off the dance floor, because that's all I wanted to do, was to dance. Once I realized it, like I could find my solace on the dance floor. And they would be like, come back when you have peach fuzz. But, you know, New York again was very different, and, you know, it was easier to go out. I mean, I went to Crisco Disco, and I got out. I went out. Like, you know, I was wild. You know, like I was jumping out. I lived on the first floor, and I would jump out the window and then climb on the fire escape and go back in. And, you know, my mom eventually caught up to my shenanigans. But, you know, I found a place where I felt, you know, like I belonged. It felt comforting. And I wanted to get out of the Bronx so bad.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. We don't think about that sort of thing anymore. Like living in the Bronx or Brooklyn or even Queens, like there was once this time where going to Manhattan was a thing. Like that's just not what people associate it with anymore because everyone wants to live in the outer boroughs now, right? So,
well, what's interesting too, Ben, is that if you were from the Bronx, you didn't mess around with people from Brooklyn or Queens. Like, we were very tribal, right? Like, sure. So you didn't go outside of your little village. And all I wanted was to get outside of my village and to see what was out there. Not that I wanted to go to Queens or Brooklyn, not that there's anything wrong with that, but I wanted to go downtown. And they told me, you need to go to the village. That's where you're going to find people like you. And that's what they told me. Like, you know, without, you know, so like I didn't know what people like me meant or what it looked like, but I sure enough found out.
So, okay. So that's a good segue into the next topic, which is the Paradise Garage. So, how did you discover Paradise Garage? Who took you? I know you're not good with years, but if you can, general ballpark.
So Robin and I tried to sneak into the Paradise Garage. Not sneak in, but we tried to go in. And now on Saturday night, which was the gay night, Friday was straight, right? And, you know, the heteros can go in. On Saturday night, if you were a female, right, like you either had to have a passport or you had to go with a member.
So wrench holders, right?
Huh?
Wrench holders could go on Saturdays. Is that right?
Yeah. So we tried to go and Noel, who was the Marlboro man in the advertisements, a very beautiful Latin man. He just told us like to go, and he took, yeah, you know, we had like a fake passport. It wasn't a fake, it was an actual one, but it wasn't Robin. And it was just, you know, we were just doing shows trying to get in, and we didn't get in, but we would go and cop drugs because on right there on Varick, like that's where they sold everything that you could want, and you could get Black Beauties, you could get acid. So we'd go cop our drugs, and then we'd go to Berlin or Mud Club or Area or wherever we were going later on.
Okay.
And when did I start going? I mean, I don't know. I started going regularly. I didn't go with Robin, but I went with, you know, my crew. I went like in the early 80s, I started going. And, you know, some garage enthusiasts or purists will say that it was awful after 82. I mean, I remember going and it was still under construction, which is pretty early, right? That would be in the late 70s. So I'm not, you know, I don't know, but I know, I remember going and I remember being, you know, at first growing into experiencing it wholeheartedly, but it became a staple.
And you became a member shortly after going? Like, how did that?
I wasn't a member. I was a comp guest because of, you know, who, I mean, I was hanging out Juan Dubois, who was Keith Haring's boyfriend, who was very dear to me and my circle of friends. We started hanging out with him. He introduced us to Larry, or at least he introduced me, and I got a comp card so I can go whenever I wanted. And, you know, I think I bought a membership once, 1 year, and then after that I was in.
Oh, you had to pay. You know, you had to pay for them. They weren't just given out.
No, you had to go and get it, and then you know, I don't remember paying.
Okay,
but you had to go downtown, Which again is just like this whole process if you're like, you know, not living in Manhattan or.
And do you remember, like, I'm sure it's a blur, like, you know, when we try to ask like favorite nights, but are there any particular nights that were like, oh, Larry, or any performances that you remember that were like?
I remember. Okay, so Gwen Guthrie singing Seventh Heaven in like lingerie, baby blue lingerie with these two muscle men behind her and like wings, all baby blue. Like, and Seventh Heaven is a favorite song of mine. Seeing Grace Jones there.
Okay.
We shot the first Madonna video in the Paradise Garage. That was really special. That was kind of like one of the last times that I really saw her and hung out with her, Madonna. Dar Braxton, who sang Jump Back and who was awful. I'll always remember that night because that was like the song of the moment. And we were all so excited and she was just a mess. She fucked it up. I saw Chaka Khan, Grace Jones. I mean, and then I was, you know, the Paradise Garage was a really special, special, special time. Hearing, you know, Mesopotamia, the B-52s, and Larry would just like have on a loop the first 2 minutes and like control Janet Jackson's again, like the first 2 minutes, just like building up this like excitement for the record to break. But he would just keep on like, you know, he would fuck with you. And I read, and I know this to be true, he was telling a friend of his, a girl, like, watch me control the room. And that's what he would do. He would control the room, and he was so precise, and he knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, you know, I'm not for nostalgia by no means, but I think that what Larry did with the technology that was available there, and I'm not an audiophile, but I know that like he was doing things that I had never heard and that I didn't hear till much later on when they created the technology to make those moments, those sounds.
So one of my, like, so bringing this back to my Instagram page for a second, I think I posted B-52's Mesopotamia, and you posted a long comment about Ma Rainey doing this whole floor show to it.
So, okay, but which again is just like, you know, and if I go, just bring me back in, you know, we talk about these safe spaces, right? And we talk about, oh, it was all communal and lovey-dovey. Like, it wasn't. You know, like, I can read you, and I would read you for filth, right? But if anyone fucked with you, we would attack them. Like, we were definitely a community, but we were also very, like, you know? So Ma Rainey and Portia LaBeija go to the middle of the floor and they start dancing. And it was like the parting of the Red Sea. Because all the kids, and it was all people of color, gay, were looking at them and they were just like, they were scared of Ma Rainey, right? Ma Rainey was no joke. She would beat you down, right? Not like, but she can defend herself. I mean, I worked at Patricia Field, which was at 10 East 8th Street, and she would always come by and we'd go out and talk and do whatever we were doing. And I mean, she would literally go up to a bunch of boys, and she was built with a tutu and Dr. Martens on and like a spaghetti strap, you know, dancer's top, and like read these guys for filth. And they wouldn't fuck with her because they knew that she would beat them down. So yeah, there was that one scene where the B-52s and the parting of the sea. And it was just, it was such a magical moment because Portia, who was an amazing, beautiful trans woman, and, you know, Moira, they turned it out. You know, moments like that really burned in my memory. And also just remembering that, like, how they were looked at and they were very other, even though they were a part of the community, there was definitely the separation with a lot of us. You know, we weren't embraced. We were looked at freaks. We were looked at being as loud. We were looked at, you know, the gay cause was to infiltrate mainstream. And there was nothing about us that was like infiltrating. We were like creating our own little world, which is what we were interested in, I believe.
So, and I want to kind of get back to something you said earlier, but it was also my follow-up question. So there is a great video of an early Madonna performance at Danceteria. And at one point, I know you're like yelling out at her in the crowd. Were you in her inner circle? And tell me about that Danceteria moment. And
okay, so she had wanted to meet me for a really long time, right? Because the Danceteria, and I'm like, I was like one of the fierce kids, right? Like me and my crew, we were like major.
Wait, who was your crew? Who was your crew?
Andre Walker, Robin Newland, Pierre Francione, Fondue, Walter Cessna. There was a crew of us that were Kerwin, Audrey. There was a crew of us, you know, and we were all like cool outer, you know, kids that came from, you know, Brooklyn or the Bronx or Queens, right? We were all people of color, but we were like major and we knew how to dance and we're fierce. So Madonna was going out with this hot guy called Joe Jones that I was madly infatuated with in English. And she was going out with him and he could do any, he could tell me to jump and I'd say how high, right? So he was like, I got someone that, you know, wants to meet you. And she was sweet. And, you know, it felt like she was infiltrating our little worlds. It felt like she was very opportunistic. She was ambitious, right? So I was not open to her in the beginning. And later on, and I've said this many times, like she grew on me and I began to really appreciate and grow fond of her. So Martin, her friend, would always tell me to like show up to these shows. He's like, you're her number one fan. So that all stemmed from that time at Danceteria where I was there in the group. And my friend Erica Bell was one of the dancers in Bags. And, you know, I was a fan by this point. So I screamed, go on, girl, or whatever it is I'd scream. And then thereafter, I would get invited to all of her shows and scream for her. And, you know, we developed a fondness. Robin and I would stay at a loft on Broome Street and Madonna lived underneath us and she would be practicing to Michael Jackson and like all the top songs, right? Like major, she's amazing, right? But back then it was like Michael Jackson was mainstream music and we were kind of like so cool and like not into mainstream. We were into like more obscure English or German. So we just thought it was hilarious that she was, you know, practicing to Michael Jackson when it was just back then, we just thought it was hokey, you know, but
premonition.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, I've been asked many times about Madonna, right? And I've always said that, like, for me, her support and love for the people who had HIV/AIDS. She was upfront, loving, supporting, putting her money where her mouth was. And for that, I will always bow down to her because she really supported the community. And like, you have to understand, everyone was dying. And I know you've heard this over and over again. It's like all of your friends are like fucking dying. Yeah. It was very... Yeah, you know, it was intense. And she was very loving and she supported Martin, who was a little cherub. He was so beautiful.
Yeah, that was actually going to be a topic I was going to get to a little bit later. But if it might be good to just kind of hop into that next, which is the effect of HIV and AIDS on the dance music community and from your vantage point and, you know.
Well, I mean, it got to a point where you didn't want to go out and dance and you felt guilty for being alive and you you know, like there was so much Survivor, at least for me, right? Like I was young. I was blown away by so many of my friends that I had lost and like people that I went to high school with, just like, you know, these beautiful, beautiful people who were, you know, who were shot down in the prime of their youth. I think it affected every aspect of my culture in that we were pressing forward with fashion, music, art. Like all of it was just being decimated by the deaths that we were experiencing. So it was heartbreaking, and it felt weird going out dancing and celebrating life when everyone's dying. And like, you know, I stopped going to memorials because I was just so tired of like constantly reliving this pain.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Was there a presence of like AIDS activism in the clubs, you know, in the 80s and 90s? Did that?
I mean, I'm sure there was. I started actually working at a needle exchange early on, and started participating in getting sterile syringes to people and doing stuff that was illegal, but that was helping the community. So there was definitely activism on my part. As far as going out, I felt less and less inclined to go out. I felt like, you know, it was much more important for me to do different things. And right. Some of that activism, I worked at a positive health project, and we would go out to the meatpacking district and talk to the trans girls who were sharing syringes because they were injecting hormones. So they were, you know, like, oh, drug addicts get it. We're not using drugs. We're injecting hormones, because they'd buy one vial and each one would get whatever amount of CCs. So, you know, I was doing what I could do, and I was going to the people that I felt mostly connected to. You know, so I think there was definitely a lot of activism. I think a lot of it, you know, those people are no longer here. And activism is such an important part of life. But we didn't have time to like take pictures and show off what we were doing. We were trying to save people, you know. So yeah, so I mean, it was definitely there. There were so many different ways that we were trying to, you know, get the government to step in, right, and people taking AZT knowing that, you know, it may not work, but I know what I'm going to look like if I don't take it, you know?
Thank you for sharing all that. So what was the like post Paradise Garage era? Let's talk a little bit about the like late 80s, early 90s. What did that look like for you?
A huge hole. That nothing could fill up for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, I think, I mean, I went to Choice a couple of times, and I love Larry. Larry was such a special person. But I also think that after a certain point, he just kind of wasn't, you know, he didn't have the sound system that he created. He didn't have this environment that he had control over. And I just feel like he was no longer at his best. And I say this with all the deepest love and admiration and respect for Larry, but like it was a blow to him, understandably so. He had the most amazing, the tools at his disposal, and then it was taken away, and he was playing on these systems that were good systems, but you know, it wasn't that great. So I saw him a couple of times and it wasn't the same. I was trying to get that fix that was not, I was never going to get that fix, you know, because it had started to change. It had started to evolve.
Okay. So let's talk about your career as a door whore, as you call it. Can you give us a little rundown of some of the clubs and parties you've worked over the years?
So I started working at the World at the door. I started there, and I was just, I was not at the door much. I was doing other things. And, you know, I'm not saying that this is, you know, I'm not endorsing by no means, but, you know, I was using massive amounts of drugs and I had access to them. So I just really wasn't working the door, but I started working the door there. And then I would just do like parties. Ellie Escobar brought up some invites that were, he was like, was this you? I mean, I worked at the tunnel. I did a ball at the tunnel that didn't last very long, that David Ian was supposed to participate and work with, but he had started getting really sick by this point. So, but I mean, I was all over doing all kinds of things. I worked at Trax with Rob Fernandez doing a party. I did parties all over. You know, I was just constantly doing things, and I was doing retail as well. And then I started, yeah.
Is that how you got into it, working at Patricia Field, or were you just because you were out in the scene? Like,
I think it was because I was out in the scene, and I was looked at as being like a cool character. I was one of the downtown characters, if you will. And you know, they asked me if I wanted to work, and you know, I wanted to make money. It was always about making money, right? So,
and the world was the first to ask you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Steve Lewis.
Steve Lewis.
And then I worked at Area. I worked all over.
Yeah, I meant to ask you about Area earlier. So, you know, I don't know. Some people are familiar. Tell us about a little bit about Area, and then we'll go back to the door stuff.
Okay. Area was on downtown, and it was a club that would change every 6 weeks. They would change the interiors, and they had all kinds of themes. So it was like a huge themed nightclub. And one of the great things about Area is that all the creme de la creme came. But the one thing that I love about Area is that they had amazing DJs. And the music was just as important as the people that were there. They had a very strict Studio 54-like door policy. Gilbert would work the door. And, you know, you'd see Grace Jones and Dolph Lundgren. There's this one picture of them walking the long hallway. There would be these windows with like little scenarios happening in there. It would be like the Museum of Natural History. There was, you know, skateboarders, America, like 1950s America. There were different themes. And they had these brilliant invites that you would get in the mail. The Area was really, really, I mean, it was very arty. It was arty. I met Sade there. I met so many different people there. It was cool.
Oh.
And we ruled the bathroom. Literally, we ruled the bathroom.
What's so special about the bathroom Area?
It was major. What are you doing in there? Give us some.
So going back to your door horror stories, I love that. So what are some of your favorite places or parties to work? Like this was like that club. I always loved working there. Always a great experience.
Cielo was fun. I worked at Cielo doing Louis Store, Louis Vega.
Okay.
That was always good. I worked at Submerser, which is really, really good. That was like really great. And then I've worked so many different parties that were just like amazing parties. I'm working at Gabriella right now, which we will see you Saturday, which is a really great space because it's not huge. Like these huge clubs are wonderful and they're great, but you really don't have that much of a door policy. There's no way of, not that you know, it's not like it used to be in terms of curating, but, you know, I guess one of the, I mean, so many people have told me that, like, oh my God, I met him here 3 years ago and now we're married and we're back for our anniversary and you let us in and you were so nice. And like these like really beautiful moments that, you know, I'm a part of, and more often than not even realizing. But, you know, I've been at Laban, I've been at Cielo, I've been all over.
And as a club goer, who are some of your favorite door whores over the years? Or better yet, if they were working the door, you were like, that is a party I want to go to. Like,
well, okay. So for me, it's always about the DJ, right? Like, unless I'm going and it's more about to be seen, the door person really wouldn't matter. But because I never, and this may sound obnoxious, but I never had a problem getting in. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was never, and I know that sounds so ridiculous, but like Howie Montag, I was a kid when we went to the Mud Club. They picked us up out of the group because there was this beautiful black girl with a blonde wig and this crazy looking Jerry Lewis boy with high waters that looked like he was on, you know, psychedelic drugs. And I wasn't. So like, I've never had a problem, you know? So seeing a door person, it never factored into, you know, but again, I was a part of downtown. People knew me. I knew people. Howie Montag was amazing. You know, he was an amazing door person. He taught me a lot just by watching him. There's this new kid, Cedric, who's working today. Now he is probably one of the best door people that I've seen in a long, long time. Sean is amazing. I mean, you know, there's great door people now, but it's very different in that, you know, you have to balance it and you have to watch, you know, it could be very troublesome.
Yeah.
Dealing with a lot of these people today.
And so what, I mean, I know you said it's changed, but what has been your door policy over the years? I know it's changed based on the nightlife landscape, but what goes into like who gets in, selecting a good crowd for, like, what's your thought process on that?
Your energy.
Okay.
Your energy. You know, like, good evening, how are you? And you could just, you know, like, you read, you know, the nuances of the person. I was working at Submerser and my manager was Stefan, who is like this amazing Frenchman who is he's running all of the standard hotel nightlife experiences. So we were doing Submerser and I let in this older woman who had on, like, you know, she looked fabulous, but bordering on tacky, which I really love. I love a tacky look. And I mean that with, like, all, you know, but like, I love when someone just puts themselves out there and it may not look perfect, but it is perfect because they're being real, they're being authentic. So he saw this older woman go down with this, you know, this paillette, like, huge sequin. And he was like, when I saw her, I was thinking, like, what the what did you do? He said, and then she got into the club and she settled in and he was like, I looked and it all made sense. And I was like, puppy, that's why I'm here. I know what I'm doing. Leave me to my, you know, leave me. So, I mean, I think of like a painting, like, what do we need? Do we need something crunchy? Do we need something salty? Do we need something sweet? Do we need something, you know, that's how I like to work. And sometimes I'm not given that opportunity because there's other things at play, right? Like, if you're the DJ, I want you to get paid, right? So I'm gonna make sure you get paid, right? So, like, you know, I work under those parameters. Like, you know, each party's a different parameter. You know, like, it depends on what you're doing and what the motivation is. But it is instinctual. It's very instinctual. And it's very, very rare that I see someone that has that instinct. And I think Sean and Cedric today for me have that like innate ability to just like cut through and like see what's good and what isn't.
And we've touched about on this, the next topic, in some of the previous questions, but and you're sitting in front of your own paintings. The audience can't see this, but of ballroom legends. So what was your relationship like to the ballroom scene?
The ballroom scene I was never into.
Okay.
Right? Like I went to a couple of balls. All of my friends were ballroom queens, but it just seemed so, it seemed like, you know, it was so obvious to be a part of that community, right? And I didn't fit in to that community. You know, I was too weird. I didn't want to look like I stepped off the pages of a Vogue magazine. I wanted to look like the kids that looked like in the face and ID. You know what I'm saying? Like I was much, I was, you know, I mean, there's a funny story where David Ian Extravaganza and Danny Extravaganza would always read me and my crew, right? Because they didn't get us. And Angie Extravaganza, I was never a Ganza, but the Ganzas, I mean, they're my family. And she would always tell them, like, leave her alone, leave her alone. Deja la quieta. Because they would, like, read me and they would give me shade. And, you know, I would pay them knocks, right? I really would. Because I knew that, you know, I held my own space and I may look weird to a lot of people, but I, at this point, had some cultural capital that I was working with. I knew that I was like, you know, doing something. So, I mean, I supported all my friends who were voguing and a part of that world, but it's not like something that I wanted to do. And I didn't want to wait 12, like I wanted to be on a dance floor. If I was out, I was either getting paid or I was working the dance floor. So like, I'm not one to go to a club and watch people dance. I'm not one that wants to watch. I want to participate. I want to be a part of the action. And I wasn't going to walk.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, did you ever walk?
I mean, I walked a ball or two, but you know, that wasn't, you know, I wasn't going, that wasn't my thing. You know, yeah. I was too cerebral. I thought I was too intellectual. No. I was into Foucault and, you know, like I wanted to change the world, you know, like I didn't see myself doing it. And again, it's where I came from. You know what I'm saying? Like I wanted to get out of my socioeconomic class as quickly as I could. You know,
did you ever do door or work with like the Club Kid or Suzanne Bartsch kind of world? Or was that like Kenny Kenny?
I mean, Kenny Kenny and I worked at the door at the World.
Right.
And again, I was like out to lunch. But I have worked for Suzanne. And, you know, the Club Kids were an interesting lot. And you know, like they were like a different generation, if you will, and they were never really into the music that I was into. So they didn't, you know, it started to change. And yeah. And that's when I started evolving out of nightlife and doing other things because I just felt, you know, it wasn't my, you know, it wasn't chic and it wasn't glamorous and it was obnoxious and it was loud and they're fierce, but it was not my cup of tea. You're like, they're major. I love them and I know them all, but you know, like, you know, they were messy.
Yeah. Very.
And it's good to be a mess. It's good to be a mess, but look good. And like, you know, again, it's the value, the judgment. What looks good for me may not look good for someone else. Just like, you know, like the ball kids didn't think I was fierce. I knew I was fierce. And I was walking, you know, in the runways in Berlin and, you know, I was doing things. So I knew that I was, you know, I was giving a look, but they didn't see me. You know, so it's all relative, isn't it? But the Club Kids were, you know, a very special bunch of kids.
And was there a moment, I mean, I'm sure for you, the closing of the garage, but did you notice like a specific time in New York nightlife where things had just shifted, things were just changed, went in a different direction than what you were used to? Or is it constantly like that?
I mean, I think it's constantly changing and I think it's constantly good. It may not be my cup of tea. Like, oftentimes young people ask me like, well, what's the difference? And, you know, they want to know. And I know that I'm alive, right? Which is a privilege to age in my community. It's definitely a privilege. And I know that it's important for me to hand down because there were generations that weren't able to hand down to me because they passed. So oftentimes I explain, but I think that it doesn't matter what time it was, there's always something happening. The youth, they're always doing something. You know, I was talking to Patricia Field the other day and she was talking about being with people who were old and they were probably younger than her, right? And she was like, they think old. I'm not into thinking old. I'm into new ideas. So I think that, you know, it's changed and it will continually change, but I think it changes for good. When the Paradise Garage closed, there was definitely a vacuum created and nothing really as good as that, in my opinion. Then the rave scene started happening, which was really exciting. And then drum and bass was happening, and that was amazing. And then like Body and Soul started coming around. The Shelter was happening. You know, so there were all these other things that were happening. And, you know, not that your expectations are lowered, but you just, you know, you're grateful for what you have at that particular moment. And to say that it'll never be the garage or there'll never be another Larry Levan, like, of course there isn't. It's not meant to be. You know, we still have Francois. We still have Timmy Regisford. We still have fucking Louis Vega. You know what I'm saying? And we have like these new kids coming in who are amazing. Nita Aviance is Nita and Will from Carry Nation are fierce. And if you don't know about that party, go listen to them. Mike Servito, D Diggs, like there's amazing DJs. And you know what's beautiful, Ben, is that they don't have that reference of Larry Levan, right? Which is great because they're able to do their own thing. And they may definitely have their references. Mike Servito is like a major hip hop. She's from Detroit. And she like plays shit that I'm like, what the fuck is this bitch playing? Like, oh shit. You're like, I love it when they do that for me.
Yeah.
But like, it's great that they don't have that. Like, you know, they've evolved into their own style. And it's so exciting. It's beautiful to see. You know, a lot. It's alive and it's thriving.
Yeah. But you took kind of my next question, but my next two questions, but. So even now or looking back, were there any DJs or parties that you went to that you just didn't feel like got their proper due respect? Like you just don't hear about it. It's like glossed over.
David DePino at Trax on Tuesday nights. On a Tuesday fucking night, you'd go out and you would get turned out. David DePino at Trax was major, 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 major. Who else? I mean, Francois K, Monday Night at Cielo was like always amazing. You know, Johnny Dinell is, you know, I love Johnny Dinell. Johnny Dinell is my fave. Like, he's my heart. He did this one song and like, he's like, you always, like, I live for him. Pero, Johnny, you know, Mark Kamens kind of never, and you know who Mark Kamens is, right?
Of course. He's someone that I feel like is more generationally known, you know, but younger people don't. And I'm glad you brought him up. So can you speak a little bit more about Mark Kamens?
Mark Kamens. So Mark Kamens was the one that would DJ at Danceteria, right? And like, I own the dance floor at Danceteria. Okay, like I owned it, right? That sounds so obnoxious. But like, you know, I would, you know, like, oh my God, it was so, they, Mark Kamins would play everything. Richard Swarette, Ivan, and Justin Strauss, like, you know, these DJs really were playing like James Brown. They were playing new wave. They were playing 50s rockabilly. They were playing punk. It was just such a melange of sounds. But Mark Kamins turned out Danceteria. Madonna and him, you know, he played Madonna's and We Know Where She's At. And, you know, he played some interesting records. He was very schooly. It was like you were learning about music with Mark Kamins. And he was like a great guy. He was a great guy.
Yeah. And, you know, we've touched on this a few times in the discussion about like these places and spaces that had such like a, you know, a range of people from all walks of life in the club. And it sounds to me like he was sort of playing to that factor, you know? And I'm sort of like, why? I mean, I got to see in my, you know, from my perspective, from when I got on the scene, the tail ends of that sort of thing where you would go to something like, I don't know, Motherfucker. And you had all these rooms and different styles, and you had club kids with rock kids and, you know, more of the dance music world all in one environment. Or, you know, going back to the late 80s, early 90s, a place like Mars or Nell's, and you just hear like uptown hanging out with downtown celebrities in the mix. I'm just not seeing that. And that's not to complain. I know things always change, but what do you think happened?
It's changed. I mean, I don't know what, you know, it's evolving. I mean, Brooklyn, I see kids, you know, it's a different generation and they react and they respond different. I mean, I don't know, you know, I see what I want to see when I'm out, but it, you know, when you go to queer spaces, sometimes it's very one particular sort of gay man that you see that I want to listen to music. And like, I'm not going to take off my shirt. I've got to look. I'm here to dance. I want to, you know, and it's not about dancing so much. And, you know, I mean, it's changed, but I cleave a space for myself. I've learned that, you know, I don't care. I mean, I was in Miami once, but for many, 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 I stayed in Miami working. And there was this Latin club called The Waterfront. And me and Patricia Field would always go. And it was right by the airport. So you'd hear the planes take off and land. And it was just like the best club in the whole wide world at that particular time. You know, so there's always like things happening. I think, you know, why it's different, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of guys watching the DJ fucking spin. It's like, put your phone away and like dance, look at each other and sing to each other. You know, like I, you know, it's just watching and not participating.
I just wanted to ask about a few clubs and you know, I'm just gonna sort of name some places and see how you respond, but I have more focused questions to round this all out. Sound Factory
was fierce. You know, Junior Vasquez had his moment. He definitely turned it out. You know, it and Frankie Knuckles, Rob Fernandez, like, you know, major talent coming out of Sound Factory. Christina Vitt, like major, you know. It was definitely a place of salvation for many of us. after living through what we had lived through and, you know, seeing people getting decimated, it was, you know, recovering on the dance floor.
Sorry. Do you remember when you first went there?
Uh-uh.
Okay.
I don't.
Okay. And then Save the Robots.
Save the Robots. Wow. Sawdust on the floor. Save the Robots was cool, but it wasn't about the music. It was about like
the drugs.
For me, doing drugs and and keeping the party going.
Yeah. That's what everyone said. You know,
yeah. I mean, it's there were pretty good DJs there, but it was never about the music. It was just like, it felt like a very desperate place, which probably didn't resonate with me but I went still. Yeah. I mean, there was nowhere else to go, you know? We would all end up there and, you know, it would be like a whole smattering of different New York nightlife being there, you know?
Okay. And then fast forward a little bit to, the 2000s. Were you ever aware of a party called Solid Gold at Stingy Lulu's?
I was aware. I never went.
Okay. Which leads me into Body and Soul. So
go ahead.
So many say that kind of kept for those that missed out on the garage, that kind of was the thing to sort of keep, besides Shelter and other parties, to kind of keep that spirit going. Would you agree with that? Or
I think it actually, absolutely. I think it definitely, it felt very much like that. But again, it's completely different. You know what I'm saying? It was a different time. It was a different set of values. It was a different crowd of people. I mean, it was completely different, but it was definitely, I mean, it scratched that itch. And, you know, major, you know, Francois, Danny, and Joe, when they get together, they create magic. And it's like they play off of each other. And it's like there's a tension, right? And I say this in the most loving way, but like they're all doing their best. And it's, you know, I feel it as a dancer. But again, you know, it's very, very different, I think, you know, and I loved Body and Soul. I loved Body and Soul.
And so
every Sunday.
And they still happen periodically.
Yeah, but they in the worst places.
Yeah.
And guys, I love you guys if you ever hear me, but like, fucking, you know, the sound system, it's wrong.
Yeah.
It needs to be a wooden floor. We need a wooden floor.
Yeah, we do. It needs a home.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's hard.
It is. It's very hard.
But reunions are boring. It's like, why do we have to have a reunion? Like every 10 years, okay. But like, do something different. Do something new. Like
that you're bringing me into my last question. So,
oh, this can't end? I want this to last forever. Go ahead. No, I'm just kidding.
So, yeah, we were just talking about Body and Soul, and there's 718 sessions, and there's these legacy New York legacy parties. And a discussion that I have with my peers and a lot of other people is, and again, you kind of touched on this earlier, is who or what's going to keep it going? What's next? What, in your opinion, what's going to keep it going in the future when Danny and Joe, they can't do it anymore?
I mean, I just said, like, there's a whole slew of DJs who are gonna, you know, who are gonna evolve, and they're gonna continually bring it. I mean, the one thing that I speak to my dear friend Benny Soto a lot about is that, you know, like you were asking me about the club kids and that whole scene, right? The reality is that we don't see a lot of them because a lot of them just got drugged out, right? Or I don't know. I think I you know, I think. But like, if you don't have a core group of supporters, of dancers who were there dancing for the music and living for you, then like, you're not going to have a future. So I think that when you go and you see these DJs, the DJs that have a following of people who dance, who may have a drink, may smoke a joint, may do a bump, whatever, but their primary purpose is to listen to the music that you're going to provide them, that's going to keep it going. There's a whole slew of people that will keep it going. And, you know, I'm hoping to be around to watch them, and I'm here to, like, you know, to encourage them, you know, but it's never going to die. If during war, during good times, we want to dance, we want to get fucked up, we want to dance, and we want to enjoy ourselves. We want to pick someone up. We want to meet someone. We want to look into each other's eyes and say, like, I love you, or whatever it is. Like, there's that, you know, we've been dancing by the fire since we began as a species. So the dance is never going to die. Doesn't matter who is doing it. There will always be a dance to be had. Right? I mean, go to Jamaica, they're dancing. Go to Australia, they're dancing. They're dancing everywhere. You know, there's always this communal need to sweat and lose ourselves in the beat. So I think it'll always, you know, I think it'll propel forward. And, you know, there'll be different people providing their different talents.
Okay. So that was the last question, but I'm just going back to something I forgot to ask earlier, or just, you know, any good door stories that you have for us?
Any good door stories? So I think this is quite fabulous, right? And I hope, you know, I don't get anyone mad or whatever. So Jennifer Lopez came to the room of the Boom Boom Room, which is the top of the Standard, you know, that beautiful room on the 18th floor of the Standard Hotel. And one of her people come and they're like, Jennifer Lopez wants to go upstairs. And now the Boom Boom Room is known. It's like the after party for it's one of the places that the after party for the Met Gala happens. It's a major place. And it was in February. It was brick. It was dead upstairs. And I called the front desk upstairs. And I'm like, J-Lo wants to go up. I'm going to send her up. And they were like, no, tell her that we're having a private party. And I relayed it to her person. He got back into his car, he drove away. And later on, and it was Stefan, actually, from you know, the gentleman that I was telling you about, a submerser. I was like, why? And he was like, because we weren't at our best. I wouldn't want J-Lo to see us when we are not sparkling and being amazing. And I was like, huh. Because, you know, I mean, you would think you want J-Lo to come in and, like, you know, but it taught me. I learned so much from Stefan. But, you know, J-Lo is a party girl. She loves to party. She loves to have fun and dance. And she was definitely not going to be dancing and having fun upstairs that particular night, you know? But, you know, I've been able to usher in some pretty amazing people, you know, and take care of them. And it's always such a pleasure. And, you know, always the most beautiful stories are the ones when people come back and tell me, like, you know, I like you at the door because I'm a female. And every time I go in, I know that no one's going to, like, it's going to be a nice group of people. And then I'm not going to be fondled and I'm not going to be harassed. And I know that I could come to you and you'll take care of me. Like, these kind of things just, you know, they're so gratifying and uplifting, you know, like to hear, like, I met my partner 3 years ago. You let us in separate, and now we're together and we're back here and you're here working the door, and it's our 3-year anniversary, and we just want to thank you and we love you, and we, you know, you've helped us create this life, which I didn't even know I did, right? But, you know, those are the beautiful stories. nothing too like outrageous and outlandish. I know, really, no, kind of, you know,
that's great,
run of the mill, but like really, you know, like these beautiful human, you know, these moments that I've been privileged to experience, you know.
Okay.
I've had some awful moments at the door too, but we won't get into that.
I don't doubt it at all. All right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So that concludes the first episode of There Is No Planet Earth Stories. Thanks for listening, and please subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast platform. And join me again next month for stories from Chicago.